You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 21st, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How are you all doing on this penultimate show of 2016?
I'm excited for the break.
I'm excited to take some time off from work, and I'm excited for 2016 to go away.
To be over. It wasn't all bad.
No, it wasn't all bad.
No, but it was it became memed that it was that bad. You know what I mean? They're just like, all the 2016 lists are like all the horrible things that happened this year. There was some good science, let's be honest.
Yeah, a couple of bright spots. The FTC ruling on homeopathy was good.
Yep, gravitational waves were good.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, Yep. The Juno mission, very good.
Very good.
We successfully streamed on Facebook our year-end wrap-up show last week.
Very good.
I was a semi-successful member on Facebook.
Yeah, there's just a couple of hiccups. I mean, you had a hard time hearing us, but that's something that I think that was a temporary thing we'll be able to sort out.
And definitely, if we can do it in person, I think it'll be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Steve, are we going to do this more often?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now that we got everything working and it's all up and running, you know, sure. Yeah, we had a great response. We had the 500,000 people reached and like 86,000 views. It was good. That was a good response.
Yeah, we didn't publicize it because we just wanted a test.
Yeah, that was mostly with organic traffic. That was just like with. Yeah.
I saw a lot of comments like, what is this? The SGU live? What? Wait, what? A lot of comments like that.
Yeah, next time we'll give advance warning, we'll promote it, and then we'll see what happens.
But people can still
a couple of months or so.
People can still listen to the episode next week, right?
Well, first of all, it's on Facebook. Just go there and watch
it.
But we will I'll be editing it as an episode. It'll be our year end wrap up episode that goes up next week. Yeah, absolutely. So this is actually the last show that we're recording, but it's the second to last episode that'll be published for 2016.
That's really nice.
It's a form of time travel.
Yeah. We give
podcast
people
time.
You know, like content throughout the year. I take 2 weeks off from my podcast because I need it. It's like the only 2 weeks I get. So I'm like, sorry, suckers, I'll see you later.
Yeah. Most normal people do. Yeah, we haven't missed a week in almost 12 years, and it's a hard streak to break, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Set a hard precedent.
It would take an apocalypse, I think, to
weather some serious events, without a doubt. Yeah. But I mean, you know, it's part of the commitment, and I think it's just really cool that people know we're going to be there. We're going to drop on Saturday morning.
I'm sure we'll miss an episode at some point. Something will happen that will just make it impossible to do a show. But
Steve, that means that we should have a total mystery show in the can.
Yes,
ready to drop.
Yes,
I've thought about that, but then the thing is, that show gets crusty. You know.
Yeah, it's like, can you only do
have to
timeless,
be timeless
stories?
Right.
Yeah, not if it's like a movie review show where that's all we talk about.
No. They all have to be super old movies.
We would have to write a show specifically that would age well. You know, that would so obviously like no news items, you know, nothing that would be timely. We could think about that.
It would be really funny if it was like a show where we did it straight, but we were predicting the future. So we were basically just doing quote unquote news items of things that haven't happened. And it'd be crazy if it got to be so stale that some of that stuff actually did happen in the meantime.
Right, Kara?
Careful.
That would mean that we're really doing our job.
Yeah.
So this episode, we're going to start with a movie review. We haven't done one in a little while, but we all enjoyed the movie Arrival so much. And it's good science fiction, maybe even great science fiction. We'll see what everyone thinks. That we thought it would be good to do a movie review. So as usual, there will be spoilers galore. We're not going to hold back. We're going to do a deep dive on the movie. We're not going to, you know, dance around important plot points or anything because we want to really dig in. So if you don't want the movie to be completely spoiled, again, the movie is Arrival. Then just fast forward to the end of this segment, which ends at 30 minutes and 20 seconds.
All right. So now that we are past the point of no return.
Yeah. We have arrived. Yes.
The base concept of this movie is that aliens come to visit the planet. And there were how many ships, Steve? 14
12,
ships?
12.
There was 12 different ships spread throughout the world. And it's not like they're at the White House or, you know, at the palace over here. They're in random, seemingly random places. And, you know, we are zooming in where the U.S. Army has built a camp around, you know, apparently like in the middle of somewhere in the Midwest in the United States, in Montana. Mm-hmm. The U.S. Army has built a camp and they're flying in specialists to interface with the aliens.
Could I say out of the gate that that is a science fiction movie trope that annoys me a little bit? The idea that when aliens make contact, the military will be entirely in charge of interacting with those aliens.
Really? That was like one of the few things that didn't annoy me, because I was like, oh, that's absolutely how it would happen.
Well, but what would be another scenario?
How about the State Department? How about anyone other than the military? But the thing is, you have to realize is that our military would be 100% worthless in the face of an alien species that could get to the Earth. If they're here, we have absolutely no military hope against them. I think we have to assume that is the case. And so putting our military forward first is the dumbest thing we could do. They offer zero protection.
I don't think that's why they did it, though. I mean, you're right. They offer zero protection. And yeah. I think that that's why the movie did a good job of showing like diplomacy first and showing the sort of tension between even more militaristically oriented nations and America, which is funny to say because like we spend the most on our military than any other nation in the country or in the world.
Then the next seven combined.
Yeah, but they did start with diplomacy. And I think part of the reason that they use that military trope, and part of the reason that I think it's probably true, which is why it's a trope, is because that's where we have direct connection with the commander in chief. That's where they're is like really stratified security clearance and really good hierarchical structure for who knows what and who is not allowed to know what. And I think that A, it makes for a good movie, but B, it's probably how things would go if aliens did make contact.
Yeah, I understand narratively why they often do that. Yeah. And like in this movie as well, the military is going to take a kind of a knucklehead military approach to it and they got to cause problems, right? So that's narratively, yeah. I get that. But I'm just saying, I hope that we learn or at least think about what a first contact with aliens would be like and realize from the thought experiment of these science fiction movies that the military shouldn't be anywhere near these aliens because they serve no purpose except to possibly show that we're militant and antagonize the aliens and we're risking a confrontation. We're risking some trigger happy, whatever, you know, general causing problems for zero benefit. I think that, sure, I get that the government is going to need to be in charge because they represent people and they have an infrastructure and a hierarchy, as you say, they can get things done. But they shouldn't send the military in. They, you know, use the military to control humans, you know, to keep us away. Right. You know, but the
guard,
more scientists. Oh,
yeah, put together a committee of philosophers and scientists and politicians and whatever, and specialists to represent us and to try to figure out what's going on. The military have absolutely nothing to offer, I think.
Yeah, and in the movie, the military are running the entire show. And on top of that, it was to the military's ends, right? So they're bringing in – the main character is a language specialist, like, you know, an ancient language specialist or whatever. And they brought her in and they brought in another a scientist. What was the scientist?
He was a physicist.
So they bring in these two quote unquote civilians to help out. But
they already had security clearance because of other jobs that they had helped the military with.
They had worked prior.
That added
so
to the whole idea. The military was running this thing and they were handling it in a very military fashion, which was very...
That's the only way they know, Jay. Yeah. What are they going to...
And you know what?
How else are they going to do?
You're right. It provides the tension in the film. But I do think it's pretty true to life. I see your point, though, Steve, that maybe it would be more like... You mentioned the State Department or even like the NSA. Kind of like the way Men in Black always presented the interactions with aliens. Yeah. It was like this secret government department specifically geared towards that.
Yeah, let's just have the Men in Black contact them. They're all used to aliens.
Now, by contrast, the movie Contact did not go that route, Steve.
Yeah.
It was maybe a slight military presence and a national security presence, but it was really a White House run.
Yeah, although that was a radio signal, not aliens.
That's true.
Think of, so try to think of, and there may be one out there, try to think of a science fiction movie in which we encounter aliens where the military is in front and center.
Mm. Well, yeah. Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
2001?
What was the how much trying to remember.
Close Encounters was military. Yeah, that was definitely military.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't recall 2001. I mean, I don't know, with the obelisk on the moon. I don't know if you call that.
Yeah, that's a little difficult to get
contact,
there.
That's a little grasp.
It was military. And E.T., even E.T. was freaking military.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, E.T. is military.
You know what trope kind of annoys me about sci-fi movies is the trope of like the super smooth, non-realistic, or at least non-physics realistic spaceship. I think that the idea is like, oh, it's so advanced, we don't even understand how it hovers, and it doesn't need thrusters, and it doesn't need fuel, and blah, blah, blah. And it seems to like disappear through a wormhole or something at the end. That's what I'm assuming. But it's like, it seems like a lot of sci-fi movies where there's contact made, the spaceship is like really egg-like. It's very smooth and just doesn't have any like of what we would recognize as vehicular features. At all.
I'm okay with that. I in my experience with science fiction, they tend to separate technology into two categories. There's technology that uses physics that we're familiar with.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some extensions of that physics, but it's using thrust, as you say, and fuel, and there's steam coming out and exhaust, whatever. There's stuff going on. Recognizable if technologically advanced engineering. It's kind of a gritty, near or not too distant future technology.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then there's the so super advanced, it's not even recognizable to us as technology. And I'm okay with that as long as that's the premise.
But is that really sci-fi anymore? Is it just fantasy? Like, I feel like they're not using science. That's the one thing, the funny thing about Arrival to me was that I get that it's a sci-fi movie because it's about aliens and it's about time, but there was not much science in it. Like, I didn't really think it was very sci-fi heavy.
No, the alien technology was indistinguishable from magic. It was Asimov's,
yeah, exactly.
Indistinguishable from magic.
Right. And, I mean, when you're manipulating,
that's fine. I'm okay with that as long as that's the premise of the
Yeah. When you're manipulating gravity and you're changing gravity to the extent that they did, I mean, you, as far as we know, if you want Earth-type gravity, you need the mass of Earth to actually do that. And clearly, they found a way around that. And I didn't have much of a problem with that.
Yeah, so what? Who cares? I mean, look.
Yeah, you know, I was fine with it.
The reason that I care is because I like sci-fi and I don't like fantasy. And when things start to drift into fantasy world for me, I have a really hard time suspending disbelief.
So you like the District 9 ship.
I love District 9 is like one of my favorite sci-fi movies.
That's a great
one. Well, Kara, I think the point here, though, and the reason why they went there with the alien technology was it needed to be there in order for us to place the aliens in a certain, like, they needed to almost be untouchable.
Yeah, and they needed to be so sophisticated, as we knew from their language, the more we learned about it. They were, like, way more evolved, way more advanced, way more sophisticated. So I get it. It's just harder for me to appreciate. The same way that, like, the military trope bugs you, Steve, this trope always kind of bugs me.
Okay.
I agree with you that I prefer the gritty technology, always prefer that.
Because it's less lazy.
Well, but I don't think it was lazy in this case. If it's necessary to the plot, then it's okay. So, I mean, so here's the big reveal at the end of the movie was that the thing. So the basic plot arc is the 12 ships are here. They're each giving a piece of a puzzle to different people on Earth. And it's kind of like their test. We only get the whole thing if we all work together. Yeah. But if we all hoard each of our piece to ourselves, we won't get the benefit. The benefit is their language. And once you fully piece together their language, it enables you to look through space and time, that's a huge gimme. I mean, that's like the big gimme in the movie. So, but if you're going to have
find it out about halfway through. I mean, they hint to it pretty heavily about halfway through.
If you're going to have aliens at the center of your story that can manipulate space and time, then you have to give them the magic level technology. I think that's
true.
Yeah, and I agree. But the thing is, though, this for me, this was the real fantasy, even more than manipulating gravity. I mean, so Louise Banks, Amy Adams' character, says they use nonlinear orthography, which is their right, which is their writing. And then she says, do they think like that too? And that was one of the key questions of the entire movie, because to the aliens, we learn time does not have a direction. It kind of puts them outside of time. And then the movie brings in the whole Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which says that language kind of shapes how you think, how you look at the world. And there's some evidence to support that. But the big idea then is that once you learn this alien, this revolutionary, amazing alien language well enough, it apparently rewires your brain to such a degree that past, present, and future are all the same. To me, that was the biggest gimme of all, beyond the gravity, beyond anything else. That was like, well, okay, that's real fantasy, real kind of mystical stuff. And it was a fun movie. I really enjoyed it, but it was also interesting for me to think about that. Okay. How feasible, you know, is that? You know, I thought about the gravity. How feasible is the gravity thing? Well, how feasible is this time thing? And it really gives you a whole, like a sixth sense vibe to the whole movie, because you immediately want to rewatch the movie because everything kind of just shifted a bit once you really learned the impact of the time. So for That's me, right. it was fun to look at that scientifically. And for the record, it's not possible, obviously.
It's magic.
Yes, yeah, but I like looking at it.
And keep in mind, you know, this is a film and the narrative comes first. And so, yeah, that's a big, you know, gimme that they're asking the audience just accept. And that's fine. I have no problem if it serves an interesting and important narrative purpose, which it clearly does in this case.
Oh, yeah, it's the whole point of the plot.
Yeah, sure. That's fine. It's not, I had no problem with that. And just to say, I mean, I did like the fact that, and you know, this is like other science fiction movies that also I think have been fantastic, like The Martian and Gravity. Mm-hmm. Gravity, I think, is still my favorite movie of the last 10 years.
Wow.
In that it was a fantastic, I've watched it like three times now.
I got to watch it again.
The whole movie was animated. You know that, right?
Only
their faces. Yeah, which is amazing.
They didn't film it in orbit? Damn.
No, but like literally none of the scenes were practical, which is really cool if you think about it.
But what ties those movies together is that they are personal stories.
Yeah.
Very personal, where the science fiction is just is the backdrop and is providing a lot of the narrative elements. But at its core, these are stories about people that are interesting and compelling and having to deal with what, you know, the science fiction is throwing at them. In this case, you know, Louise Banks, Amy Adams' character, this is a great twist I thought in the movie.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, she keeps having these flashbacks to a daughter that she had that died of cancer as a teenager. And then you realize at the end of the movie that that's not a daughter she had in the past. That's a daughter she's going to have in the future.
Yeah, it's a flash forward. Yeah.
Yeah. And that but going into that, so she has this child knowing it's going to die of cancer as a teenager, and she accepts it, and she's like, and this is, I think, what tied in so nicely to the time is nonlinear. It's like you look at your whole life at once. You don't worry about the, you know, where things are going. You know, or where you are right now, you look at the whole thing. She's like, hey, I'm going to have 15, 16 years with this person that I love, and I will, you know, enjoy that and get a tremendous amount out of that. Even though I know where it ends up and that's sad, I would not give up those 15 years. You know, and that's interesting. That takes a lot of strength and a perspective. I mean, you know, knowing that you're going to lose a child
and lose your husband because of it.
Remember? Right. It also breaks up the marriage.
That's right. She loses everything.
She tells him before it happens that she knows it's going to happen, and he leaves her because he can't handle it. And he's, you know, the other scientist in the film.
That's her sacrifice.
The annoying thing, I think, was that they feed that to you in a really beautiful way. Like, really is so much character development, and it's a very emotional movie, you know? Like, people get teared up in it. The score was incredible. It's actually very haunting to me.
Big part of the movie.
Yeah, because I listen to that song in my mix when I'm at the airplane, at the dentist, or when I'm going to sleep. Like, that's one of the songs in my kind of modern classical mix. And so that theme that they used a lot, like, I don't know, it triggered a lot of memories for me. But beyond that, I think I was a little annoyed how much they spelled leveled everything out at the end just in case you didn't get it. And that's just a thing about movies in general that kind of bug me. Is
yeah,
like,
I agree
oh,
with you on that.
Let me make sure I say it out loud because the 30 references I made to it might not have clinched it for you. But beyond
I get
that,
Kara, I get that. I mean,
I'm okay.
I think it's,
I'm okay
there's
with
a lot
it.
Of it's a tough line to walk. You know, they have to put the safety in there to make sure that everybody gets
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but I don't like it when movies are so
including
obvious. Like, I love it when a movie actually leaves some things up to you to determine.
Yeah,
like, huh? Did they really mean this, or did they want us to think this? But this movie has none of that. It's all spelled out really perfectly for you. One thing also that kind of weirded me out or bugged me is she flashed forward to when she wrote the book. There were two things, actually, and then I'll get off of the soapbox. The first one is she flashes forward to writing the book and selling it, and like she speaks their language. Nobody else seems to have this skill somehow. Like she's the only person in the world who could learn their language. I don't understand. Their language was provided. Other people should be able to learn it. So that's one thing that annoyed me. The other thing that annoyed me was the actual plot twist part where she saves the day by calling the Chinese, head of the army, by telling him his wife's dying words because he told her in the future, which would never have happened if she hadn't saved the day. So
time
that's
loop,
where you get in one of those time loop things that's kind of annoying. I felt like they could have come up with a better device than that.
Hmm. Yeah, but if time's not linear, it's all happening at once, you know what I mean? It's kind of goes along a little bit with the gimme, but
that was actually the part where, you know, it was supposed to
that's
be like a cool
out.
Aha moment. We're like, okay, this is how it's stitched together.
But
Kara, like I get what you're saying. Like a part of it is a little like it goes against our science acumen. But in that moment, you understand that guy who was in charge of China and their efforts completely got it. He had a complete change in his perception, and you know he was epiphany. Going down the wrong road. Yeah, he had an epiphany there, and it was important for him to do that because he was paying back what he received in a sense. I mean, I understand why they did it that way.
I think we're supposed to have trouble wrapping our heads around this because we don't speak
true.
The alien language, right? our brains haven't been changed in a way. So I think that is part of the movie is that it doesn't make sense. You can't really wrap your head around it. All right, guys, let's pivot.
Okay.
Let's talk about the aliens, right? We got to talk about the aliens.
The heptapods.
The heptapods.
Yeah, why were they naked?
Because they don't need clothes. They're too advanced. We'll be naked one day again.
I really enjoyed the fact that they picked these types of creatures to represent the aliens. You know, they were not human looking at all. You know,
they didn't have faces.
And everything about them was done well from an alien perspective. You know, their language was alien. They didn't really talk like we do. They didn't look and act human in any way. They didn't even live in a human environment. They lived in, I guess it was like some gaseous
soup
that they lived in, that they flew around in. So it was, they did that very well.
I was very happy that they weren't humans with funky foreheads.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah, I love aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And this is even, do this think it's an A minus for aliens because I reserved my
minus.
A plus for aliens that are not analogous to anything on Earth. And
gotcha.
These were seven tentacled octopi, right? I mean, they had
heptapods.
They were heptapods. They had seven, you know, tentacle like. But they were kind of more finger-like than tentacle-like.
It was kind of like two in the front and then five for ambulation, right? Because it seemed like they only ever wrote with their two front hands.
It's like if you were walking with a seven-fingered hand.
Was that each tentacle could open up for finer manipulation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yes.
So, Steve, did it bother you or were they not alien enough for you?
Well, A minus.
I'm just saying it's
good,
A minus. It's an A minus, but I have to leave room for the aliens that are so alien, they're not even similar. There's no analogy to any creature that we know on Earth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like not carbon based would be big.
Like in
pure
Cosmos.
Pure energy.
Yeah,
creatures.
That's how it was in Cosmos.
Pure energy, that would be.
It had to take
likely.
Another. Well, it had to take another form in order for us to really understand it. And
pure energy is kind of a cop out, though. But David Brin, you know, wrote an alien that was basically like a stack of fatty rings. You know, it's like there's
the Michelin Man.
There's nothing. There's no analogy. Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
What
no,
book was
no
that,
analogy
Steve?
To any creature on Earth.
Yeah, that's pretty
Steve.
Cool.
I see what you're saying, but it gets to the point where it's a tall order to come up with something.
Of course, it is.
That,
That's why he said A minus. It's still pretty good.
That's why you get the A plus for that, if you actually pull that off.
I'm very impressed that you said A plus.
But why was their ship so big? That's what I want to know. It was like two of these things.
They were not
that big. They were kind of big.
Size is relative.
Because why not?
Size is relative.
Because they just lived in a cavern. Like every time they showed them, they were just in this soupy cavern with no stuff.
But that was just where they were interfacing with the humans. We don't know where they're actually hanging out.
Well, but they brought her into their world in that one scene and made her somehow not suffocate.
But she never got beyond the antechamber, though, right?
No, yeah, she was in the mist. Remember the scene where she's fully CG? It's like
she was on the other side. Yeah,
she was on the other side of that veil, because they also blew up the chamber, like the glass.
She crossed over.
Yeah, she crossed over, and she was like with them in their mist. But it was just kind of this ambiguous, like cavernous.
Yeah.
I guess they don't have to eat. I don't know.
Well, all right.
It's
part
fine.
Of it, Kara, part of it is it's creepier if it's a big ship.
Yeah, I agree. And it's creepier if it's just like you can't see through the haze.
Yeah.
Yeah, what you expect, like a couch and TVs and stuff? I mean,
I don't know. It's like The Simpsons. Oh, yeah. These aliens weren't that different than The Simpsons aliens.
The aliens were intimidating, and I love that. The noise that they made, the sheer size. And the way they moved, and of course, there's a little creep value when you have more than a few appendages. That worked very well. They didn't look evil. They just looked like creepy and
imposing.
Otherworldly, without a doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
I liked that their means of communication was not oral at all. They actually said there was no correlation between the grunt, or maybe it was just something they didn't understand, but much more like what we think of as animalistic kind of grunts and vocalizations. But the actual communication, the writing was still, it came from inside of them. They like inked into the space.
That was very creative. And I want to give kudos to the movie for making linguistics such a huge part of the movie. When's the last time you saw a sci-fi movie about linguistics?
You might argue that they solved the language too quickly. I think there would have been too many variables, and I don't know that we are technologically capable of really figuring
that
out.
Right, it could have taken a decade to make significant progress.
They did say that it took months. Like, they showed that they were...
It was months.
Yeah, they didn't say it was days. They just didn't do, like, traditional montage-y things with music and time passing by. They just... that was in verbal exposition.
Well, this was the part that bothered me, because as a fan of sci-fi, of course, and... the whole idea about meeting and interacting with aliens and actually having, peaceful communication with them, which I found to be refreshing. It wasn't like leading up to them destroying the Earth or whatever. They had positive intent behind it, like a good intent behind the whole thing. But I didn't feel like I got to sink my teeth into the idea that they were trying to communicate with the aliens enough. I know that they did it, and they did show you that they were going through steps and all that, but I wanted that to be a lot more. I like the discovery process. You know how, like, the scientists were shifting into excitement and elation when they were starting to unravel it and make the connection. And of course, the military is starting to get more pissed off and angry because it's not going as fast or the direction they want. That's somewhat predictable. I wanted a little bit more of the nuts and bolts, so I can partake in their victory in learning the language and getting past that language barrier with them. You know how, like, we always say, like, they're going to use mathematics to communicate and whatever. I didn't feel like we had enough of that. And I know that the movie actually wasn't about that. This movie was definitely not about really about that. This was all window dressing.
It was a device,
But the sci-fi fan in me wanted the movie to be like half of that. I just needed so much more.
I do like a slow movie that holds my interest.
Me too. Like,
you could really luxuriate in the movie and think about it. And you're not just, racing from explosion to explosion. But of course, it's always risky. And some people said that the movie dragged a little bit in the middle. But I think
that Jay liked.
if you get fully engaged, it could hold your attention even through parts that are where the action is slow. That's a sign of a really good movie.
Oh, yeah, I also like that the whole movie was melancholy. Even the joyful moments were really bittersweet in the film. There was just this darkness and this kind of sadness that, to me, is very attractive in sort of a coming of age or a biographical sketch of somebody, because it really felt human.
And the arc with the daughter, I think held that all together, because there is no like beginning, middle, or end there. It's just all sort of at the same time. And the idea is that existence is bittersweet, and that was sort of all wrapped up in that her memory of you know, her future memory of her daughter, that the, that daughter's whole existence. I mean, there were moments where, you know, you just, you know, you have the parental joy of an adorable child that you could love with, you know, more than you could possibly imagine unless you actually have had kids. And then you having to watch that child sick knowing that they're going to die. I mean, that's existence. It gives, yeah. It takes away. It's all, you know, that everything ends. Everything has an arc to it. That's just existence. And I think that they captured that really well. And it became sort of the glue that held the movie together. And I think that that's what you're experiencing there. Like the whole movie, mm-hmm. had that same melancholy, because that's life, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It was beautifully shot too. Yeah. Like there was a grayness to it.
It was beautiful.
Kind of like House of Sand and Fog to me. Like I'm remembering her house. It looked like she lived in Portland or someplace where, yeah. it was just foggy and gray all the time. And, yeah. it was just stunning.
All right. So overall, excellent movie. Highly recommend it.
Yeah. It was no Prometheus.
Definitely.
Yeah. It was the anti-Prometheus.
All right. Kara, start out the news items with this. This one's been really all over the news the last couple of days about female doctors.
Yeah. Okay. So there is a report that was just published in, do you pronounce it JAMA when you're calling it for
JAMA,
sure?
Yeah, JAMA.
You do. Okay. In JAMA Internal Medicine, actually. Here's the title. Let's start with that because you've probably been seeing different headlines in popular news outlets. Comparison of hospital mortality and readmission rates for Medicare patients treated by male versus female physicians. Probably the headline that you're seeing over and over is female doctors are better for their patients, or patients less likely to, superior to male doctors, patients less likely to die if they have a female doctor, all this kind of stuff. Let's talk about what they actually looked at. They decided to focus on Medicare Part B patients that were admitted to hospitals. And that was for a lot of different reasons. I think some of them were like ease of records, but specifically, they did a kind of correction to their data by using these patients that were specifically admitted to hospitals because they found that there would be less bias in their data. You know, if you're just going to your general practitioner, you chose that practitioner. So there might be all sorts of bias in whether or not you wanted a female versus a male doctor and whether or not they wanted to choose you. Were you too sick for them to take on? Did you have other kind of reasons that they wouldn't want to take you on? But at a hospital, it's quite common that you can't pick your doctor. You're just kind of assigned to whoever's available. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to make sure that that was kept clean and unbiased in that regard. There were a lot of other things they did to control for these biases. So right there, they looked at Medicare Part B patients in hospitals. And then they looked at two measures. They looked at mortality. Did they die within 30 days? And they looked at readmission. Did they come back within 30 days? They also extended that later in the analysis to 60 days to see if the effect still held. And then they looked at basically, it was the doctor, the primary treating doctor, so the first person that patient saw, male or female. Admittedly, that was self-report, so they said they weren't able to control for any trans doctors or any individuals who might have chosen to abstain from saying what their gender was or might have chosen male versus female, even though that didn't really appropriately describe who they were. But there you go. That's breaking down the title. So it was a lot. They looked at a lot of people. So let me find that. 20% random sample. Okay. Beneficiaries 65 years of older. They were looking at people who were treated by general internists from January 1st, 2011 to December 31st, 2014. And it was a lot of people. It was 1,583,028 hospitalizations. And the amount of individuals was 621,412 men and 961,616 women. And that was for mortality, and then somewhat similar numbers for readmission. They also decided that they wanted to kind of parse out a lot of the data to see if different things factored into whether or not men or women had better outcomes in their patients. And we're talking about male versus female doctors, not male versus female patients. They wanted to see if, for example, 8 common medical conditions, the 8 most common that they found in the Medicare data that people actually were admitted to hospitals for, did these different conditions fare better? You know, did like female doctors do better on heart patients versus male doctors doing better on kidney patients? Let's look at all of that to see if there's any sort of variability there. And the outcome basically was that a very, very small yet significant difference existed across almost every measure. Some of the measures had a small difference that was not significant, but as reported in the study, all of the measures fared better on the female doctor side versus the male doctor side, or in some cases there was no difference. They never actually reported any situations, and tell me if I'm wrong, Steve, but I couldn't find any where male doctors fared better with patient outcomes than female doctors.
No.
Yeah, they never found any, but they did find that most of the measures showed a significant difference. Some of them showed a very small but insignificant difference, and that significant difference was at a p-value of less than 0.001. So it was, you know, it was pretty stringent. And after they added all of these different analytic controls, like controlling for the condition, controlling for whether or not this was a hospitalization.
Age of the physician.
So let's talk about what the actual difference was. This was like a 0.5% difference. Actually, slightly less than a 0.5% difference. What was it? 0.43%. Here's what the writer said. Quote, the first question everyone will ask is whether the size of the effect matters. I'm going to reiterate what I said above. The effect size is modest but important. If we take a public health perspective, we see why it's important. Given our results, if male physicians had the same outcomes as female physicians, we'd have 32,000 fewer deaths in the Medicare population. That's about how many people die in motor vehicle accidents every year. Second, imagine a new treatment that lowered 30-day mortality by about 0.5 percentage point for hospitalized patients. Would that treatment get FDA approval for effectiveness? Yup. Would it quickly become widely adopted in the hospital wards as an important treatment we should be giving our patients? Absolutely. So while the effect size is not huge, it's certainly not trivial. So I think that the authors effectively make the point that from their analysis, which is only the second of its kind, and the only previous analysis was not done for hospitalized patients, and it was done with a way smaller sample size, they think that this is important enough to make sure that individuals know about it. But as we know, in the kind of public or general media, a lot of people are really sort of overvaluing what was said. And there is some precedence for why they would say this. If you look in the introduction of this study, they actually do note a bunch of previous studies that show some important parameters that they think may be contributing to why female physicians have better outcomes. And one of them, which I really appreciated, it perked my ears up, was that there are previous studies that show that female physicians are more likely to adhere to clinical guidelines and evidence-based practice.
Yeah, which is, in my mind, this is my bias. That's like the big thing, the big glare.
Exactly.
It's could not explain about the whole effect female. Right there. Yeah.
It could. And that's what they were saying. They even said in their study, there's nothing inherent about being male or being female that would explain this. So there must be something about the way that female physicians versus male physicians practice medicine that may be contributing. And I think the reason this is important, and the blog post does a better job of explaining this than the actual, you know, like clinical study, which is full of a lot of jargon, is that it's at the very end of the blog post. And I think I'll just quote it again because he says it better than I do. Another important point must be addressed. There's pretty strong evidence of a substantial gender pay gap and gender promotion gap within medicine. Several recent studies have found that women physicians are paid less than male physicians, about 10% less after accounting for all potential confounders, and are less likely to be promoted within academic medical centers. And they even mentioned in the study that a lot of female physicians will not be able to get certain positions because of worries about pregnancy. You know, a lot of the things we see in academia. So that said, I think it's that much more important that this information be out there, even if it didn't say patients of female doctors fared better, but it said they fared exactly the same. I think it's just another piece of evidence for, like, there's no reason women, female doctors should be paid less or treated any differently within medical and academic institutions because they have good outcomes. And that's the most important thing for a patient. So yeah. There you go.
So let me put the data into a little bit of perspective, a little bit of further perspective. So yeah, so the difference is very small, 0.43%. But whenever you're talking about death, obviously, even the slightest advantage is important because, you know, when you apply it to the whole society, you end up with numbers that are meaningful, like, you know, 32,000 fewer deaths over the course of a year. So
yeah, it's funny because we think of 100% as like 100 people. So then we're like half a person, but no, you've got to.
It's a half a percent. But the other thing is these are all statistically significant because you're dealing with 1.5 million hospitalizations. So when you have numbers that high in a study, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Obviously, it makes it a very powerful study. But what it also means is that any subtle effect in there, as even a subtle confounding effect, is going to easily achieve amplified statistical significance because the power is so high of the study. This is not a randomized or controlled study. So, patients are not being randomized to male versus female doctors, which means, you know, it's impossible to completely eliminate confounding factors in one study. You have to look at this multiple ways, multiple different, you know, times to see if it holds up.
Which is weird because they mentioned that you can't do a study like that.
You never will be able to do it. That's why
is it unethical?
You have to triangulate as best you can. Well, how are you going to do that? I mean, with any kind of real numbers. But you're not going to get to these kind of numbers.
That's true.
You're not going to see this kind of effect size with that kind of study.
Yeah.
We need robot doctors to.
So again, to put that number further into context, the number needed to treat. So in other words, in order to prevent one death, you would need to have 233 patients treated by a female rather than a male doctor. So that helps. The number needed to treat is a good way to put things into perspective. If you look at it from the point of view of an individual patient, because I know the worry is that the public's going to see this and go, oh, I want a female doctor, not a male doctor. But the probability of that making a difference for you is really slim. It's not worth worrying about. Also, the final thing to keep in mind is that the difference among male doctors and among female doctors is orders of magnitude greater than this statistical difference between male and female doctors, right?
So this is just the average over all of them.
Having said all of that, I have absolutely no problem believing that female doctors have better outcomes in the inpatient setting. My own experience is female doctors in general are fantastic, and especially They for some reason, this I think just whatever culture, they really operate really well in the inpatient setting because there's so many interpersonal relationships that go into managing a patient on the inpatient side. And women, in my experience, this is totally subjective. It just seems that the female doctors are just so much better at that than the male doctors on average, right?
And there's actually some evidence to support that because they show in the introduction, you know, often in an introduction, it's a big literature review. So they look through other studies and they show that literature has shown female physicians are more likely to adhere to clinical guidelines, provide preventive care more often, use more patient-centered communication, and perform as well or better on standardized examinations, and also provide more psychosocial counseling to their patients than do their male peers. Yeah. There's also studies just of patient satisfaction with their physicians. And it shows that generally female physicians score higher on patient satisfaction than the male physicians.
That's all interesting. And I think that the most useful thing about this is like, well, what can we fix, right? What can we improve?
And what can we learn from the way,
if the adherence to guidelines, and there's other independent evidence which shows that adherence to evidence-based guidelines leads to better outcomes. That's a little bit circular because, you know, evidence shows that evidence is helpful. Yeah, okay. but I think it's totally legitimate. If for whatever reason women are adhering to guidelines more than their male counterparts, that may explain this. I just think, just in general, my observation is that women communicate on average better. Now, the caveats that the authors put in the study, and I think you have to point out this is about internists on the inpatient service. That does not necessarily mean that this would be the same for surgeons or for other specialists. And this does not mean it would translate to the outpatient side. Outpatient practice is very different than inpatient practice. And the differences may not translate. So I would be very interested to see the similar studies done in other settings and other specialties to see how it holds up. And that would be a great way to try to isolate, try to triangulate to what are the critical factors here?
Yeah.
What do they have in common? Or if they're different, what's different and how does that inform it? So this is...
Yeah, you could do a factor analysis or something.
This is one slice of the evidence. It's very interesting, but this has to be part of obviously a lot more studies. Many more studies to try to really get an idea of what this is telling us. But I do think absolutely just on this evidence alone, this undercuts any argument that women deserve to be paid 10% less than their male counterparts.
Yeah. Or that they shouldn't get promotions because they're less likely to contribute.
Very interesting. All right, Jay, tell us about all that water on Ceres.
Ceres is a dwarf planet. Mm-hmm. It happens to be the only one in the inner solar system. So the inner solar system. Well, how do you guys define the inner solar system? Is it from Jupiter?
Jupiter.
Inside Jupiter.
The asteroid belt divides? It's just inside
inner
Jupiter.
It includes
the asteroid.
Oh, it includes the belt.
Right.
Okay.
So it's from the belt in. So Ceres was discovered on January 1st, 1801 by an Italian named Giuseppe Piazzi, and he discovered... Hey. He discovered Ceres by accident. He was looking for a star and found Ceres, and he named Ceres after the Roman god of agriculture. Ceres revolves around the sun once in 4.61 Earth years, and it's located in the asteroid belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. And it is the smallest known dwarf planet at 950 kilometers, 590 miles in diameter. Mm-hmm. So this is a really cool body. It makes up the majority of the asteroid belt, or I think was it a third of the asteroid belt? But
yeah.
It's big. It's taken up most of the real estate in that asteroid belt. I also read that it's considered an asteroid and a dwarf planet. I didn't quite get that because I figured the definitions.
Yeah, it's both.
Really crisscross. Yeah,
all right. It's both.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But the thing is, the news is that Ceres is wet. And we didn't know it. It's odd to think that it has as much water as it does. But NASA's Dawn spacecraft analyzed Ceres on December 15th in 2016, and they announced that it turns out that it has a lot of water. The water is frozen in ice deep below the surface, and it's locked in hydrated minerals on the surface. So they were able to detect this and get an idea of how much there is. So billions of years ago, NASA thinks that the water was mostly in liquid form on Ceres. And it was moving around quite a bit, and it was also separating Ceres into layers of rock and ice. And now that it's much more frozen, or you know, maybe even completely frozen, we're now able to take a look at it with the Dawn spacecraft and see, you know, okay, what's going on there. So if you think about it, you know, there was geology was actually happening. You know, there was the movement of liquid and interacting with the regolith deep into Ceres and on the surface. Really freaking cool. So there's also a 4 kilometer high ice volcano on the surface, which is, what the frick
Whoa,
is an ice volcano?
What's an ice volcano?
I know.
It's like an oxymoron.
It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a mountain of ice that spews forth ice. Yep. It's, yeah.
Oh, it doesn't spew forth lava.
Right. It's an ice volcano. There are ice volcanoes on multiple moons in the solar system, not just Ceres.
You should have done a science or fiction about that. None of us would have known.
I did a few years ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
I don't think a body that small could produce magma, not without massive tidal forces, maybe if it was in orbit around a giant planet.
Yeah, like Io. Ceres has deep craters on it that never see the light of day.
See, that's and that's
so there's so frozen neat. Water yeah. at the bottom of those craters that never melt.
Captured
like
it
super
all
permafrost.
Long
yeah,
time like, ago,
and though. You would yeah. guess that if it was in liquid form on the surface, that it would just boil off and just kind of float out into
yeah.
space.
Yeah, yeah.
So, bottom line here, takeaway is, you know, we know now that Ceres has water on it, and I was thinking, you know, how cool would it be if we needed water for some emergency on Earth, and we had to send a mission to Ceres to collect some of the water, some of the ice over there,
or drag Ceres closer
well,
to Earth.
Well, I mean, hopefully that's not going to happen, but.
Yeah.
What we will use Ceres for is as the water supply
base on the way.
For way station or whatever for the solar system. Yeah, when we start occupying the asteroid belt, absolutely all the water's right there. We don't need to bring it from Earth, for example. And you could also split water into hydrogen and oxygen, then you have your fuel, you have oxygen to breathe. Yeah.
Oh, it solves a bunch of problems.
Now why isn't that we ever find you know, an asteroid that's covered in coffee or something. Like, you know, why is it always
Because that like defies our laws.
I'm just saying, Kara. It'd be nice though, wouldn't it? You know, like a nice medium roast.
Yeah.
that should be. You should write a new sci-fi that features that. Yes. It'd do really well.
All right, Bob, tell us about light from antimatter.
Yeah, this is fun. So here's a quote from Nature. We report the observation of the 1s-2s transition in magnetically trapped atoms of antihydrogen in the alpha-2 apparatus at CERN.
Woo-hoo!
So, okay, what does that mean? That sentence is arguably the biggest antimatter news in decades. It means that researchers and engineers have made antiatoms stable enough to coax them to emit light. Not only that, they found that within experimental limitations, of course, antimatter light is identical to light emitted from regular matter. So that is big. This was accomplished by the Alpha Collaboration at CERN's antiproton decelerator facility. And this is after 20 years of effort. This has been one of their specific goals for 20 years. And they finally did it. This facility is able to produce boatloads of antiparticles, which are theoretically just like regular particles, except, as we all know, the opposite charge. Now, because if you're dealing with these antiparticles, because they're charged, they're easy to manipulate. But when you put them together and you have, say, an antiproton and an antielectron, which is a positron, the antihydrogen atom becomes neutral, right? The charge is balanced, which makes it harder to manipulate. So that was a sticking point. It's very difficult to handle it and do what you needed to do with it. So what they did was one of their breakthroughs, I guess, was they created a special magnetic trap that takes advantage of a very tiny residual magnetic field of the antihydrogen atom. And so the bottom line, the result at the end of the day is that they can now produce 25,000 antihydrogen atoms every 15 minutes and trap 14 of them. Now, okay, 14 doesn't sound like a lot when you're dealing with 25,000, but previously they were only able to trap one of them. So, that's a huge increase, and it seems
consistently
to be
one on average.
It was like 1 point something on average.
Gotcha.
So they do 1, 2, 3, 1, none, I guess. So now they can do 14. So every time they're getting at least a dozen, it seems, of these antihydrogen atoms. So then once you've trapped it, then you can start doing these experiments. And in this case, they shined a laser light on the antihydrogen atoms. This light has a very specific frequency that causes the regular hydrogen, regular normal hydrogen to produce a spectral emission. Now, I know what you're thinking, Jay. A spectral emission is not the result of ghost sex. Atoms can absorb energy, which causes the electrons to jump to a more energetic orbital. And then it releases a specific wavelength of light when it drops down to a lower energy orbital. That's kind of just basically how light is created. Now, the specific frequency of radiation that an atom can absorb and emit, those are fingerprints of that atom. No two atoms are alike in terms of what, you know, the frequency of what they absorb and emit.
I see.
And this is the basis of spectroscopy, which is one of the most fundamental and invaluable tools in all of astronomy. I mean, with it, we know, you know, what stars are made of. I mean, how critical is that? So one of the specific frequencies of light that can make hydrogen do this is the same frequency, apparently, for an atom of antihydrogen. So they shined laser light that would make a regular atom of hydrogen do its thing. And the antihydrogen did the same thing. It released the same frequency of light. So that is the big finding of the experiment. That's pretty much the huge breakthrough. They've been working all this time just to make that happen. But their work, of course, is not done. It's never done. The light seems to be the same between the two, but the precision could be much better. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, why are we so interested in antimatter that we want to get even more precise than a few parts per 10 billion? Well, there's a bunch of reasons. First off, it's just the pursuit of knowledge. I mean, come on, hello. That's always kind of there in the background. But for antimatter, one of the biggest mysteries regarding antimatter is why is there so little of it? If you look at our Big Bang models, they predict equal amounts of matter and antimatter at the birth of the universe. So then, there was this titanic battle to end all battles. And the visible universe is the tiny remnant or residue from that, you know, matter and antimatter basically wiping each other out. But that begs the question, if there were equal amounts, There should be no matter left. So why was there? Why is there this tiny residue of matter? So there must be some asymmetry between matter and antimatter that could cause that. And that's what they've been trying to find out for a really long time. Essentially, we need to confirm with as much precision as possible that matter and antimatter are obeying the same laws of physics. Because if they aren't, then physics would go through some changes to rival anything that has gone before, perhaps even the quantum revolution. It would be a huge, huge deal that probably we'll never get there. It probably won't happen. But if it is, that would be a total game changer. Mm-hmm. So may you live in interesting times, I guess.
Cool. All right, Evan, tell us about purple food.
Yeah, purple food. I read this one in the Telegraph, of all places. And their headline says, "Start eating purple food for good health." The science behind 2017's new food trend.
New
you got to love
fad.
That. Yeah, you gotta love that. Yeah, food trends, food fads. You already know there's a big old red flag there. And they say, according to experts from Whole Foods,
that line alone just gives me the willies.
So many red flags.
Experts from Whole Foods. Yeah, scientists.
We asked a scientist.
What he would have told you is. And they examined consumer behavior globally across 465 stores. They're saying that our plates are going to look very colorful this year, with purple foods in particular expected to fly off the shelves. In an online statement, the health food company described the phenomenon as a fast-growing trend. Richly colored purple foods are popping up everywhere. And actually has a link to Whole Foods newsletter, online newsletter, whatever the hell it is. And they list the top 10 trends for 2017. It kind of reads like an old David Letterman show top 10 list in a way. For example, number 10, wellness tonics. Yeah. Okay. This year's hottest picks will draw on beneficial botanicals and have roots in alternative medicine and global traditions. Oh God. Yeah. Right. That's exactly what I want. They talk about products from byproducts, using oil, Ecoola is using water from its olive oil production as the base for a household cleaning line.
Oh, coconut, well, that's kind of smart.
Well, coconut oil, you know, and coconut everything. They say everything's going coconut now, you know.
Yeah.
Not just coconut water, coconut tortilla, you know, come on, here's a whole bunch of.
So it's that sounds disgusting. Crap. Did you say coconut tortillas? I don't want that.
Coconut tortillas. Yeah. Coconut sugar, coconut based products are on the rise. And of course, purple power. Here's what they say. Richly colored purple foods are popping up everywhere. Purple cauliflower, black rice, purple asparagus, elderberries. I remember someone's mother once smelled of elderberries. Yeah. purple sweet potatoes, purple corn. And there you go. The power of purple goes beyond the vibrant color and often indicates nutrient density and antioxidants.
Wait, they didn't say eggplant in that list, which is the only purple food I know of?
All right. The most obvious sort of one. The article goes on to have interviewed this gentleman, Matthew Plowman, a nutrition advisor at Cardiff Sports Nutrition, whatever that is.
Wait, what is a nutrition advisor?
Yeah,
that's like a bullshit title to me.
Nutrition advisor, right. Certified nutrition and analysis.
He's a nutritionologist.
He agrees that purple foods are full of natural health benefits. Of course he does. He said the benefits of antioxidants have long been discussed, but they're known to fight disease, keep you younger, reduce inflammation. They're good for your heart. Basically, why wouldn't you eat them? Well, nutritional advisor Plowman, you may not want to eat them because maybe they do more harm than good, actually. A nutritional advisor Plowman has never read real science-based information on antioxidants. For example, a few years ago, an article in Scientific American looked into some of the latest studies of antioxidant consumption. They found some surprising results. For decades, researchers assumed that highly reactive molecules called free radicals caused aging by damaging cells and thus undermining the function of tissues and organs. But recent experiments show that increases in certain free radicals in mice and worms correlate with longer lifespan. Indeed, in some circumstances, free radicals seem to signal cellular repair networks. If these are confirmed, they may suggest that taking antioxidants in the form of vitamins or other supplements or even foods can do more harm than good in otherwise healthy individuals.
So it's complicated. And the best way to look at it is that we have evolved a homeostasis of antioxidants plus oxidative free radicals, et cetera. It's already there. The most powerful antioxidants that we know of are ones that your body makes for itself. And nothing you eat is going to come close to the antioxidants you already have inside your
body.
Can
we synthesize these and take them though, Steve?
But here's the thing. If you needed more antioxidants, if the optimal level of antioxidants was higher than what you already have, you would have it. Because there's no reason why your body wouldn't have already evolved to the optimal balance of antioxidants, because it has. Well, so gaming that system by just saying, I'm going to take extra antioxidants and beat evolution. Wrong. You're not going to do that. Yeah.
This just goes back to that weird fallacious way of thinking that like you're absolutely what you eat. That like you don't do anything inside of your body. Everything is just produced because you ate it.
Right.
Like, yeah, there are some things that we have to source externally.
Literally vitamins. Some, like, yeah.
Yes, yes. Like that where we have to eat them and then that's the only way we will get them. But then there are other things that because of a combination of like sunlight and like the processes that are existing within our bodies already and these different things interacting, we're going to continue to synthesize on our own. And somehow that's just all in a big bucket to most people.
So let me give you my thoughts on purple food. First of all, I have no problem with purple food. I actually think it looks very enticing. I love colorful food. And as a rule of thumb, it's a good idea to eat a variety of colors because colors do signal different nutrients. And so if you're eating things that are green and leafy and dark and yellow and purple and orange, you're going to be getting a good variety of nutrients in your food as well. So I'm all for purple. I've actually seen purple cauliflower. It looks awesome. I love weirdly colored food too, like purple corn. I'll eat that any day. It's fine. But what's irritating is they make it into a fad. And then they go the whole antioxidant bullshit route. How about just eat food of a lot of different colors and look, where there's some funky purple colored stuff that's not normally purple colored. But what's interesting is how did they make all these purple foods? I know they're not genetically modified, but they're modified, right? I mean, these are,
they are genetically modified. They're just not transgenic.
Yeah. They're not transgenic, but I mean, you think that, yeah, these are not like, corn is not naturally purple, but it's like they're switching a channel, right? It's like, oh, purple's good. Just ignore the fact of how we created all these purple cultivars, we're not doing the natural thing now. Now we're doing the antioxidant thing. And, even though they don't, they're mutually incompatible. All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
Last week, I played This Noisy. What the heck is that?
I think it's bacon.
What is that?
Bacon.
It's me reaching into the Sun Chips bag. Remember when they used to make those loud, obnoxious Sun Chips bag? They stopped making them. That's what it sounded like.
All right. So Evan, a listener of ours, wrote in. He said, love the show. I am not a member, just a casual listener. And he said that I have a submission for Who's That Noisy. I am a semi-agricultural profession. I'm in a semi-agricultural profession. It's not exactly like there's a lot of noises out there, but here's one for you. And this one is the sound of corn growing.
No, how?
Purple corn?
Yes, corn popping? Corn
it
growing.
It is sped up, but this is a day of corn growing. Or 8 hours of corn growing.
Wait, it's the actual corn growing, not just the... not just the husks in the wind?
No, it's the sound of corn growing. So what happened? Now, Bob and I have heard this, by the way, because we used to do a lot of...
very slowed down, of course.
Yeah, Bob and I heard the noises. So what happens is the corn grows very fast. It does this thing where it actually breaks the bonds between the cells. And then when they heal, it sounds very similar to something that happens to humans biologically with muscle tissue, it heals back with more of the of corn... fiber or corn cells, right? So they're breaking and healing, or breaking and growing, however you want to describe it. So sped up over 8 hours, it sounds like that. There's a lot of it happening in each plant. And when you have a huge amount of these plants growing right near each other, it makes an audible noise. And if you record 8 hours of it and speed it up, it's quite an interesting
thing.
That's
pretty slick.
So it's because of, I guess it's because plants have cellulose and like they have, really thick cell walls and we don't. So if the walls themselves break, that's weird that you could hear it.
Nobody guessed it. Bob didn't even try. even though he had the baseline information in his head.
Steve was, never would have got that in a million years.
Steve was wrong, and Evan is completely silent.
I said Sun Chips. I was the closest, actually.
You were the closest. Close,
Evan. Come on.
All right, so moving on to this week's Noisy, a listener named Darren sent in this crazy and arguably one of my favorite Noisies. I'm going to let it play through three times. Just take a close listen.
Will you marry me?
That's what I heard.
Excellent, guys. Excellent. Right. I'm proud of you. That is actually correct. That is what is being vocalized. However, that is not the full answer because who's that Noisy has layers to it like an onion. So.
It's an onion saying, will you marry me?
It is. If you heard any cool Noisies the past couple of weeks or you think you know the answer, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
I always cry at onion weddings.
This is really bad, Evan. This is like one of the worst, Evan.
All right, next is a piece of an interview that we did with Brian Sweetek about a recent interesting fossil discovery. The full interview, which runs about 30 minutes, is available as premium content. So if you are a premium member of the SGU, you can listen to the whole 30-minute interview. Otherwise, here's about a 10-minute piece. I know some people like to skip over the excerpt if there's a full interview available. So if you do, just skip ahead about 10 minutes to the science or fiction segment. We are joined now by Brian Sweetek. Brian, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Brian, you are a science writer and amateur paleontologist. You have a blog for Scientific American Blogs. It's Laelaps, L-A-E-L-A-P-S. People, if they search on it, they'll find it. Author of a couple of books. My Beloved Brontosaurus, When Dinosaurs Ruled, and Prehistoric Predators.
Yep, and Written in Stone was the first one, so all fun fossil stuff.
Well, your website says that you are interested in science that rocks.
Well said.
Grew up in New Jersey where, you know, the fossils were few, but the pop punk trend was strong, so that was a way to put it together. Yeah.
So we asked you to join us for the show tonight to talk about a really cool news item. Some scientists discovered a feathered dinosaur tail preserved in amber. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was, you know, I woke up on Twitter one morning and just everything was nuts. You know, everybody sharing this new discovery. So there is an amber mine in Myanmar, and the amber there is about 99 million years old. And just for as long as anybody can remember, people have been digging amber out of this place, and it has some really exceptionally preserved specimens.
Which place is that?
And so this is an amber mine in Myanmar in Southeast Asia.
Wait, isn't that Thor's hammer?
Joke.
Sorry, joke. I know it's not.
But yeah, I mean, this is the sort of thing that, you know, no one's ever seen anything quite like this before, at least not coming into the scientific market. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of these fossils are sold. You know, fortunately, this one got snapped up by, I think, the lead author of the paper, Li Dazheng, when he saw it there. And yeah, it's part of a dinosaur tail, you know, right down to the fuzzy little feathers. It's, you know, as if somebody kind of, you know, if someone really mean snapped off a piece of a dinosaur's tail and dipped it in amber, this is more or less what you'd get.
Wow. How do you know that it's, or how did they know that it was authentic? Because I know a lot of kind of fake fossils or fake amber replicas are sold a lot.
Yeah, my horrible father-in-law fell for that one once and tried to give my wife a fake scorpion in like what he thought was amber that he picked up in Mexico. So there are a lot of fakes and frauds and stuff like that that are picked up and sold. So that's a great question. You know, when they looked at it, it actually had like the bone and the anatomy in it. They did some chemical tests on it because they wanted to know, you know, does this thing have actual skin with it? You know, what are the original sort of organic components of this thing? Unfortunately, as good as it looks, it's all desiccated. You know, you see many of these fossils in amber and you think, oh, it's like perfect. It's like in Jurassic Park. Like if you just remove the amber, it would be like looking straight into the past. But it is a little bit modified from what it used to be. But, you know, the anatomy, the bony anatomy is still there. The feathers are still there. The chemical signatures are still there. You know, some of the skin has turned to more of a carbon film. But through both the anatomy and the chemical tests, they're able to verify that this is the real deal.
And you know what everyone else out there is thinking is, could there be any DNA in the soft tissue that's preserved? But that's way too long, right, for DNA to survive.
That, yeah, that's the obvious question, right? Because this looks like something straight out of the beginning of Jurassic Park. Unfortunately, yeah, DNA just does not last that long. It starts to degrade at death. I think based upon moa bones, so these big flightless birds that used to roam around New Zealand until relatively recently, some tests done on those found that, you know, even under ideal conditions, even if you have something, you know, like bones or a fossil specimen that's in, you know, a really cool, dark kind of like naturally refrigerated kind of cave, 6 million years and all the DNA is gone, basically. So from the time of death on, as it decays, DNA has a kind of half-life, just like radioactive minerals do. And based upon that half-life, basically all traces of any DNA are going to be gone. So it's about 60 million years, too short to even get us to the very last of the dinosaurs, much less something in this. But there's the potential for other biological compounds, other proteins. So you have things like the remainders of collagen, which is a very common and useful protein in, you know, living animals that they've extracted from a Tyrannosaurus rex femur and from other fossil animals. They've gotten similar sort of remnants of these original biological compounds. So even though we're not going to get DNA, there might be some interesting biological material that tells us something new about the biology of these dinosaurs if they drilled into it carefully.
Yeah, although I hear that the T-Rex collagen is still a little controversial, right? There are some dissenting opinions from that conclusion, from what I understand. Have you heard that?
Been, but yeah. I mean, that's something where, you know, exceptional claims require exceptional evidence. In this case, I think that one has really been put through a lot of intense scrutiny and has been, you know, verified over and over again. So at least, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it looks good that there are, you know, remnants of these proteins left in these fossils that, you know, it's not, you know, pristine, but there's still something left. And I mean, we have other fossils that's true for. So, you know, those coil-shelled ammonites, those like sort of fossil cephalopods that look like nautilus, that were relatives of those, you know, living squishy things. Some of the original materials in their shells, a mineral called aragonite, it passes through pretty much unchanged to us to the present. It doesn't get replaced. So, I mean, we have a sort of a precedence for these kinds of fossilization that will give us something, you know, back from those days, back from, you know, the depths of time.
Yeah. Now, how do they know that this is a dinosaur tail and not a bird tail?
That's actually a really good question. And some people are bringing up that idea that maybe this is not a non-avian dinosaur tail. Maybe this is an avian dinosaur tail. I mean, for a long time, you know, birds and non-avian dinosaurs coexisted. You know, the earliest birds go back to about 150 million years ago. I know Karen knows this because she's got it on her arm. Archaeopteryx, the first bird, it's back in the Jurassic. And, you know, many of those early birds had long tails. They had claws on their wings. They had teeth. You know, many of these, you know, ancestral dinosaur traits. So this is just a bit of tail. From the vertebrae inside, they could only see two of them through the scans and through sort of peering through the amber. And they seem to be more consistent with juvenile Celurosaur. So they can't narrow it down further than that. So Celurosaurs were the group of dinosaurs that included Tyrannosaurs, you know, the raptors, the ostrich mimic dinosaurs, you know, the Oviraptorosaurs, all those sort of fluffy, fuzzy, feathery, sharp dinosaurs. So that's about as far as they're able to narrow it down. But there's still the possibility that this belonged to some kind of you know, prehistoric bird as well. So it's definitely a dinosaur, however you define it. It's just where exactly it's going to fall.
Yeah, avian versus non-avian, but definitely within that clade. But yeah, from what I understand, they sort of extrapolated out from the anatomy of the vertebra where they were oriented or situated in the spine. And from that, they kind of figured, yeah, this is a configuration that existed in the non-avians, not in the avian. So it looks pretty solid to me, but they are extrapolating from the two clear vertebra that they could see. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, so far, and you know, who knows if, you know, maybe with better imaging technology or some other technique that hasn't been applied yet, they can narrow that down even further. So it looks pretty good, but I mean, that's the thing. Science is full of surprises. It could always, you know, pop off onto a different branch. So it's definitely a feathered dinosaur. It's just what lineage it belongs to.
Why can't they see more of the bone? Why just two segments? Why not? Can they do some sort of some scan that will just let them see like some sort of X-ray, MRI, whatever, to see all of it?
Yeah, I mean, they had done some of those in the paper you can see some of those reproduced. And it looks like they mostly got the surface of it. So for whatever reason, the scans that they used didn't so much show the anatomy behind the feathers and the sort of desiccated skin. So it was really this only small like patch that I guess where the skin and the feathers had worn away that they could peer into this one small part. So maybe there's some other technique that they could use. They did use some of these advanced imaging techniques, but it really only got them the outside view of all the details of those feathers, which actually brings up something that I wanted to make sure I mentioned, because one of the cool things about this find was that it told us something unexpected about feather evolution. So, ever since paleontologists started figuring out that non-avian dinosaurs had feathers, they've been trying to replay, okay, how did feathers evolve then? Like, what's the actual step-by-step process from how you get to something that's just a single filament to something that allows you to fly, like an asymmetrical flight feather? It's an incredibly, wonderful piece of, biological evolution. So one of the ideas was you start with basically like a single wisp, almost like a hair, just the single little thing sticking out, and then from that single sort of follicle, you get a whole bunch of little things branching out. But after that, it got really confusing, which way did feather evolution go? And there are two ideas. One is that the next step kind of looked like a Christmas tree with a central vein and all these little branches kind of sticking off to the side. And the other one was that it was almost looked like a bunch of like tentacles of a cephalopod almost sticking out with little side branches coming off of each of those branches. And this dinosaur tail seems to show a combination of both in a way. So you have this sort of central sort of vein with these larger sort of little spikes or little filaments sticking off. And on those filaments, there are even smaller ones. So it's something that sort of nobody had anticipated before. So it further gives us something to look into the steps that feathers went through. And going from simple body coverings to something that's flying. Yeah.
So my understanding was that this is actually what they did predict. That, so the question is, did the rachis form first or did the barbs form first? And they said, well, based upon developmental biology, they thought that probably the barbs formed first. And this supports that because there's already barbs while the central rachis is still in the process of forming. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, it was just in a slightly different shape than they expected. But yes, it supported the sort of the barb first idea rather than that central vein forming first.
And this is these feathers are primitive, right? These are not fully modern bird feathers where the barbs, align and link up to form that smooth, surface that a flight feather has. This is clearly a primitive feather, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's something that hadn't really been seen before in this. Yeah, an archaic form of feather. And that, is a good reminder that, feathers didn't evolve for flight. Often that's a question that I often get when I'm talking about feathered dinosaurs. It's like, well, why is that feathered if it obviously couldn't fly? So there's all kinds of reasons to have feathers, from insulation to display to just creating a barrier, between the skin and the outside world. There are all these different reasons to have feathers. So this is a good reminder of that not all feathers. Three dinosaurs had to be flying dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a strong hindsight bias in thinking about evolution where you think things were heading towards their ultimate destination, but they weren't heading anywhere. They just were what they were at the time.
Yeah, it's what worked for whatever they needed them for.
Yeah, if birds never evolved, we wouldn't think of feathers as being for flight. They were whatever they were being used for.
Right, or if most birds were like penguins or ostriches and didn't fly, we'd think of them differently.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a fantastic specimen. I mean, it's just gorgeous. You look at it, the fine details of the feather anatomy, the way that they're preserved. This is this kind of find doesn't come around very often. Well, Brian, thanks so much for joining us on the show. It's been fascinating.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. Do you guys remember what my last science or fiction of the year theme usually is?
It's a recap of the year, isn't it, or something?
Like big stories of the year, or maybe small stories?
It's the science news from 2016 that we may have missed.
Oh, crap.
These are news stories that we did not talk about. So I pull these from the whole year, not just from the last week. Do you remember that, Bob?
I do now.
Yeah.
Painful reminder for Bob. Yeah.
Okay, here they are. These are all stories from 2016. Item number one, a study found that subjects deliberately infected with hookworm had reduced symptoms of asthma and improved lung function. Item number two, scientists described a fossil of a 520-million-year-old arthropod with an exquisitely preserved nervous system showing the structure of the ventral nerve cord, ganglia, and individual nerves. And item number three, measures taken to preserve the prairie dog inadvertently precipitated the extinction of the already endangered black-footed ferret, the prairie dog's main predator. Bob, go first.
Okay, if you're infected with hookworm, it could reduce your symptoms of asthma and improve lung function. Sure, either way, yeah, I can't think of anything that would be for or against it, which I hate. So let's see, you've got a 520-million-year-old arthropod. Really, exquisitely preserved nervous system? I don't know, man. I've never seen anything like that. I'm skeptical of that one. Let's look at the last one. So they're trying to preserve the prairie dog. They precipitated the extinction of its predator. So yeah, I can kind of see that. You know, you're trying to save the prairie dog, so you're going to have to deal with its main predator. And they think maybe they were just a little bit overzealous and took it out. Wow, not a good move. Yeah, I'll go with the arthropod as fiction. I hope it's true, but I've never seen anything like that.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, this first one about the people that were deliberately infected with hookworm, they had some reduced symptoms of asthma and improved lung function. Yeah, I mean, I could draw a line from that saying, okay, maybe that the hookworm made the body react in a particular way that released some type of molecule or chemical that did something. It's plausible. The second one here about the scientists that they described this fossil, 520-million-year-old with that kind of preservation. I don't know, Steve. It's pretty cool, though. I wonder how much good, if it is true, I wonder how much useful data we were able to pull out of that. Okay, I gotta put that one on the back burner real quick. And this last one, these measures were taken to preserve this prairie dog. Jesus, those badass black-footed ferrets, man. Now, clearly what they should have done is just organized like a mud wrestling match between the prairie dogs and the black-footed ferrets, raised money by pay-per-view, and then they all could have just relaxed with their funds afterwards and not have to actually kill each other. But, okay, so I don't know, Steve. Yeah, I'm going to say that three is science. I could see that a screw-up like that happening. So therefore, I'm going to say that this 520-million-year-old arthropod is the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Hookworm individuals who were deliberately infected with hookworm, which, like, why would you sign up to do that study, had reduced symptoms of asthma and improved lung function. This could be a total lie or it could be true. But we do sometimes see that parasites actually do have more of a beneficial nature to them in a certain percentage of the population. So it could be the case. That's sometimes why they persist. I don't know. I'm going to backburner that one. I do think there was a 520-year-old, million-year-old arthropod with an exquisitely preserved nervous system. And this seems to be the year of discovering really well-preserved things. Arthropods fossilize really, really well. We know that in general. And so I feel like it would just only be a matter of time until we saw some of the structures that were a little more detailed. Like when I look at a couple of the trilobites that I have, they're exquisite. So I can only – and those are just like whatever, you know. They sell them at a shop. I can only imagine what some really important scientific discoveries would show. The one that's really sticking out to me is the prairie dog one, because if I read this carefully, and tell me if I'm like misinterpreting it, Steve, measures taken to preserve the prairie dog inadvertently precipitated the extinction of the already endangered black-footed ferret, the prairie dog's main predator. Prairie dogs don't need preservation. Prairie dogs are like rampant. There was a time when they all had, you know, they're a carrier of bubonic plague. I know this about prairie dogs. Maybe there was a time when they were getting wiped out from that and they wanted to try to preserve them. But this one, the reason this one really sticks out to me is because prairie dogs are like kangaroos. They're everywhere. It's more of a red flag to me than the hookworm. I'm going to go against the group. Ah! And say the prairie dog wants the fiction.
And Evan.
Gosh, Kerry, I think, you know, you hit on it with the prairie dog. That was what I was thinking as well.
Really?
Yeah, the preservation of the prairie dog. I don't see it. In fact, I thought maybe the opposite was true, that it's more about the ferret and the preservation of the ferret to some regards. I was wavering a little bit on the arthropod, but you sound like you really know what you're talking about there. So I'm
good at that. Don't trust me.
I'm with Prairie Dog and Kara as fiction.
Okay, so you guys are evenly split, which means that you all agree that a study found that subjects
so
only affected.
He sounds really happy. I hope this wasn't a sweep.
Oh, and reduced symptoms of asthma and improved lung function. You guys all think that one is science. Yeah. And that one is science.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm reading too much.
So into mean, my mood. Steve.
So, yeah, this is interesting. There's a little bit of implied deception here. The subjects were mice, not people.
Oh.
Never said they were people.
That's why they signed up.
Yeah, you're like, who would sign up for this? They didn't have much of a choice.
Oh. Squeak, squeak, squeak.
We're mice.
Squeak, open your mouth.
Squeaking. So you might think, why would this be the case? Why would hookworms? So hookworms are a parasitic worm. They get into your body through your lungs generally. They find their way down into your small intestine where they bite onto your small intestine. They actually live like a hook mouth, and they got like two pairs of teeth, and then they just suck your blood.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
They can be asymptomatic, or they can cause diarrhea and gastrointestinal symptoms, which is how most people discover that they have it. The hookworm secretes a protein in its saliva that is a powerful anti-inflammatory. That makes perfect sense, because if there was a significant local inflammatory reaction where it bites into your small intestine, that could interfere with its feeding. So it evolved an anti-inflammatory in its spit. This is just like, you know, like leeches that evolved in a blood thinner in their spit so that they can continue to suck your blood. It won't coagulate, you know.
Vampire bats too.
Yeah. So, and we've isolated the spit, you know, of certain animals that suck blood because they have natural anticoagulants in them. Well, the hookworm has a natural anti-inflammatory, and that anti-inflammatory protein apparently had a beneficial effect on asthma, but also could be useful in treating a host of autoimmune diseases. So the next step in the research now is to isolate that protein and see if we can purify it as a drug, so you won't have to, you know, get infected with a hookworm to get the benefit.
Sounds better.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it could lead to a new powerful anti-inflammatory drug. We'll see how that works out. But
in 5 years, yeah.
Yeah, five, ten years. Okay, so we'll go to number two. Scientists described a fossil of a 520 million year old arthropod with an exquisitely preserved nervous system showing the structure of the ventral nerve cord, the ganglia, and individual nerves. Evan and Carrie, you think this one is science. Bob and Jay, you think this one is the fiction. And this one is science.
Yes!
Oh, whatever.
Good work, Kara and Evan.
Bastards.
I took Kara's lead on this one, I admit.
I'm so glad I wasn't wrong.
This is from March of this year, and I'm like, how did I miss this one? Because this is amazing. The fossil itself is beautiful, and the detail is exquisitely preserved. I mean, from 520 million years ago. So we're talking shortly after the Cambrian explosion. And this is like a basal arthropod, right? This is one of the first arthropods.
Wow.
I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce the Latin name of this thing. Arthropods, in case you don't know, that is the group that includes insects, arachnids, and crustaceans. So, you know.
Lobsters.
Yeah, bugs and lobsters and spiders are all arthropods. There's also a lot of other arthropods that are no longer extant, like your trilobites, Kara. Trilobites are arthropods.
Huge Why are they group. Hers?
Because I mentioned them.
She just mentioned them.
But you don't own trilobites, right?
I have two of them.
I have a couple of trilobite fossils too. They are pretty, very pretty.
They're really pretty.
Yeah.
Sometimes and, you can and see they like eyes.
They were all over the place. They were ubiquitous. I mean, they just ruled the seas until
they were the cockroaches of the sea.
They were the cockroaches of the sea. And they got wiped out. Just got wiped out.
Taught them a lesson.
So this very, very important fossil find because it really tells us a lot about the anatomy of the arthropod nervous system at the base of their group. And so we could tell, therefore, groups that evolved from the basal arthropod, like tardigrades, for example, that certain things were present at the beginning and then lost rather than evolved later, right? So if a feature exists at the root, then you know, descendants that don't have it must have lost it rather than it appearing in other branches that still do have it. So that's basically the importance of this. Yeah, I mean, it shows that the nerve cord is the invertebrate equivalent of our spinal cord. They don't really have a brain, but they have, you know, ganglia, which are just clusters of nerve cell bodies. And this specimen even showed individual nerves going to paired limbs.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Gee, how the hell did really it, cool.
How was it so preserved?
Well, because their bodies are super hard. But all of that should have been soft. So
yeah, no, those the soft structures were just well preserved. Yeah. Just a really good fossil. That's you awesome. Know, it's one of those. It's like trapped between two plates, so you have the two sides. You know, but I guess just did.
It yeah, got, those are the coolest ones.
It
where
got
the limestone
squished
just
in just
half.
The right way. You know, it just depends on how it gets squished. You know, so it's not all folded in on itself or anything. It's nice and splayed out, and just you could see it. This detail is just amazing. Which means that measures taken to preserve the prairie dog inadvertently precipitated the extinction of the already endangered black-footed ferret, the prairie dog's main predator, is the fiction. But there's a lot of elements in there that are derived from truthiness. So, Kara, you mentioned that prairie dogs carry the plague, and in fact, the prairie dogs were being wiped out by it. I mean, entire colonies were gone, and they were starting to get concerned about the prairie dog. And the black-footed ferret, their primary prey is the prairie dog. So the black-footed ferret was at risk of extinction because its main food source was dwindling. Yeah. So what they did was they started they were dropping peanut butter laced with vaccine to the prairie dogs. They were eating the peanut butter, getting the vaccine, and that was allowing their populations to bounce back, and that actually saved the black-footed ferret.
Peanut butter saved the ferret.
Yeah, because it you know restored the prairie dog, which the ferrets need. You know, they eat other things like mice and rats and stuff, but without the prairie dogs, you know, they could not survive.
Is a black-footed ferret a lot bigger than a prairie dog? I feel like those are the same size.
They're about the same size. They climb
That's
into
crazy.
They go down into their holes and they eat them, you know.
That's awesome when two animals that are the same size, one is the prey and one is the predator.
Yeah.
That's
no,
crazy.
The ferret is a carnivore. Yeah. Yeah, so this actually so it kind of flipped it. It's that we've actually saved this is the year we saved the black-footed ferret by saving the prairie dog by dropping vaccine-laced peanut butter down to them. Yeah.
And so was the core intention to save the prairie dog or was it to bounce them back save the ferret?
It was to save the prairie dog and it had the other effect of also saving the black-footed ferret. So now the prairie dogs don't die of plague. They get eaten by ferrets.
Aww, happy ending.
Yeah.
And everybody's happy.
Less violent.
And the universe is back in balance.
Exactly. Right. It's like I told my daughters when the snake ate the bluebirds.
Oh, right.
If no snakes, first of all, snakes have to eat two. And if they didn't eat bluebirds, bluebirds would take over the world. It's all the circle of life.
And then they had nightmares of bluebirds.
They were perfectly happy with that explanation.
People don't have an inherent fear of bluebirds.
The bluebirds. They come. All right. A couple of quick announcements before we get to the quote, Evan.
Mm-hmm.
Jay, we have a date for Nexus 2017.
June 29th to July 2nd.
Yeah, June 29th, July 2nd. So later than we usually have it, where it's a bit of
July
an experiment.
July 2nd.
No, we want that's it good, because it's right before the 4th of July.
The 4th of July.
Cutting it close to my birthday, guys.
We're hoping people are going to want to like just go to New York City and make a weekend of it. You know, and you can even hang out for the New York City fireworks if you want to.
Neat.
Or not, but you still have a travel day if you need to get somewhere else. So anyway, we'll see how it works out. But we wanted to be after graduation to see if we get more students and, you know, people who are going to be free for summer break. We shall see. We'll see how it goes.
I like
but it. We're going to have a great lineup for this year. We're just getting started putting it all together. But we put together a really good team, a lot of fresh blood. and we're really looking forward to it this year. So Nexus is the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. It's a full weekend of talks and lectures and panels and workshops on scientific and skeptical issues. The last couple of years, we've had a full day of science-based medicine, and that is tentatively still in the plans for 2017 because you can never get enough science-based medicine. But there's going to be a lot of other stuff as well. This is basically a save-the-date announcement, and when we firm up details about keynotes and other events, we'll be making more announcements to get you up to date on that. Well, the other thing I was going to mention relates to Evan's quote, but Evan, I'll let you take it from here.
So it was 20 years ago, almost to the day, on December 20th, 1996, that we lost Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
He's still with us in so many ways today and resonates, and in some ways even made perhaps even stronger because we look upon him for inspiration, continued inspiration from his writing and his work in the past. And he does continue to feed those fires. So here's one of his more memorable quotes. In science, it often happens that scientists say, you know, that's a really good argument. My position is mistaken. And then they would actually change their minds, and you never hear of that old view from them again. They really do it. It doesn't happen as often as it should, because scientists are human, and change is sometimes painful. But it happens every day. I cannot recall the last time something like that happened in politics or religion.
Love it.
It's true. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We miss you, Carl. 20 years.
We lost him too soon. It would have been nice if we had him for another 10 or 20 years.
Definitely. Ugh. Definitely.
All right. So, guys, so next week is our year-end wrap-up episode. We've already recorded it, but I'll edit it down, and we'll put that up as our last episode of 2016. And then the first episode of 2017 is also episode number 600. 600.
Wow. 600.
600.
Twice as good as 300.
Holy crap.
Kara, you unfortunately will be away that week, so you won't be joining us, but maybe you'll be sending me some pre-recorded contributions.
It's not so unfortunate from my perspective because I'll be on a beach in Kona. But
no.
I will send you. Yeah, we do the predictions in that episode, right?
Yeah, you have to record from the beach, Kara. Come on. Where's your dedication? But we're going to get somebody to replace you. We're going to get George Robb to join us for that episode.
He's Sausage Fest. Okay.
But if we're going to do it, it's going to be with George.
Yeah, yeah.
George, I was going to say, I can't think of I'm honored that that's who you would replace me with. But Sausage Fest works too, Bob.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, great year.
Thanks, Steve. Great year, and next year will be even better.
Absolutely. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.